Hello everybody, Julian Charles here of themindrenewed.com, coming to you as usual from the depths of the Lancashire countryside here in the UK. And welcome to TMR number 258, which is another in the series of movie roundtables that we've been doing quite a few of during this pandemic period, although this one is slightly different in that it's a swap cast with Anthony Rotuno's new podcast called Film Gold, and also different because he's playing the role of host this time, which is interesting for me because I get to be one of those having the questions asked of me rather than always asking the questions, so that's quite a nice change for me. Joining us also is Jennifer Tyson, the classical singer, who's been on TMR a number of times, and the three of us are chatting about the fantastic movie from 1993, Groundhog Day, starring Bill Murray and Andy McDowell. But before I share that with you, or more correctly, I suppose, as it's a swapcast, before I jointly release that audio, I just want to say something first. I am very conscious that there's a lot of worry and fear as regards COVID-19 vaccinations and proposed vaccination passports and certificates. And I very much share in some of those worries and some of those fears. And I don't want the fact that I am releasing this week two podcasts of a lighter nature, this one today and one of a much lighter nature in a couple of days from now. I don't want that to give the impression that I'm unconcerned about what's going on or that I'm not prepared to engage with such questions. That is not the case. I am very concerned, particularly about vaccine certification and the swift drift towards a your papers please kind of society, and the likely mission creep into digital certification being hooked up to digital identity, digital currency, social credit, and all that might mean in terms of control over our lives, much of which we already talked about with Patrick Wood and others. But now this kind of thing is upon us. And I, like many of you, I'm sure, am very concerned about where all this is heading. So I do want to address it, but I want to do it in the right way. I don't want to be sensational about it. I want to talk to somebody who is knowledgeable about what's going on, who is also concerned, but who can, you know, articulate those concerns in an informative, hopeful, as I say, non-sensational manner. And I've asked Big Brother Watch here in the UK if they would like to join us again. But so far, I haven't heard back from them, which is a pity because they're involved in parliamentary committees discussing such matters over here. I guess they're super busy at the moment with all that's going on, and TMR is way down the list of media entities to speak to because it's so small. And that's fair enough, though slightly disappointing. I might try them again. Anyway, you get the picture. I am trying to identify who to speak to and, if possible, to arrange the right kind of conversation. So I am intending to address these very concerning developments, but not this week. This week, I have two other shows to put out, and that's just the way it is, and I'm not going to let the news headlines deflect me from my schedule here. I simply haven't got time to work any other way. So that having been said, here is today's show, number 8 in the TMR Movie Roundtable series with your host, Anthony Rotuno, Jennifer Tyson, and yours truly discussing Groundhog Day. And I hope you enjoy it, and I'll speak to you again, hopefully, in a couple of days from now.
To Film Gold, episode 6. And today I'm delighted to have two guests, or collaborators, I should say, because I'm hoping they'll help me out during this conversation. And that's, first of all, Julian Charles of The Mind Renewed. How are you, Julian?
I'm very well. Thanks very much for inviting me on the show.
Well, this is technically a swapcast, so welcome to your own show as well.
Yes, anyway. Yeah, thanks for agreeing to do this. Thanks for being on TMR again.
Yeah, and hi to the TMR audience. They've seen me a few times, or heard me a few times, I should say. Also joined by Jennifer Tyson. Now, Jennifer, I just met you today, so can you tell the audience about yourself, please?
Yes, thanks for having me. I'm really excited to be here and really appreciate being in your company with both of you. I am a classically trained singer and have a very niche-y sort of specialization in early music, so music written from the 1100s to the 1750s, medieval, Renaissance, Baroque music, that sort of thing, and just happen to be a big Julian Charles fan, the Mind Renewed fan. So that's kind of how I got pulled into some of the fun, exciting moments of podcasting with all of you guys. So this is really great stuff.
Excellent. Julian, can you just tell us about The Mind Renewed, just for my audience? Because this is a new podcast. We're only on episode 6, so can you just tell us a little bit about that?
Okay, well, the Mind Renewed, which has the subtitle Thinking Christianly in a New World Order, is a podcast and a website that I started back in 2012, so it's now in its ninth year. And as the title sort of suggests, it's a bit of a mixture between Christian subjects and, in inverted commas, alternative media subjects. That's a very sort of broad approximation. It's more about various philosophical, theological, political, geopolitical, in particular, subjects broadly looked at from Christian theistic worldview perspective, because that's where I'm coming from. And it does touch a little bit on matters conspiratorial where appropriate, but there are a lot of things that I won't go for, some things I will go for. It just depends on what I think is credible, interesting, and important. And, various kinds of programming, a lot of interviews with people, some quite well-known people from, all walks of life, really. Christians, non-Christians, alternative, mainstream.
Ah, it's a fantastic show. I've been on it a few times myself. You and I have had some rather epic conversations, haven't we? Because we generally talk for about 2 hours after the recording as well, don't we?
Oh, wow. What about hypernormalization? That was real epic, wasn't it, Anthony?
If he'd broken it into parts, it would have been fine, but it was a bit of a stamina test otherwise. And all these rather bizarre sort of associations. But anyway, so let's get on with the show. So the film on the docket is Groundhog Day from 1993. The first thing I wanted to establish, actually, I'll get your opinions. What is the genre of this film? So I call it a rom-com because it has comedic elements. It's got the crowd-pleasing ending, I suppose, of the leads getting together. Some people call it fantasy rom-com. Somebody would call it a comedy. Some people wouldn't even call it a comedy. So what do you guys think? Any ideas?
Well, this isn't necessarily my opinion, but just as somebody's opinion, the American Film Institute in 2008 listed it as number 8 out of the 10 greatest films in the fantasy genre, just simply fantasy. But yeah, I could kind of go for I would say rom-com, really, probably. Maybe fantasy.
What do you think, Julian?
Well, I have a bit of a thing about categorizing anything, really. I'm not saying we should never, I don't like the idea of don't use labels about anything. I don't mean that. But we do tend, I think, too easily to place things into categories. I think, I will go with fantasy rom-com because clearly there are fantastical elements to it. There's a romance in it and it's very comic. Mm. But then I think even within that genre, within that category, do I really want to put fantasy first? I mean, rom-com suggests that it's more romantic than it's comedy. So nuancing, I think I will go for something like fantasy com-rom. How about that?
Nice.
Well, fantasy but even com. That, I will say, doesn't capture it because it sounds like, oh yeah, it's just another fantasy com-rom. But it's not, I think it's, a very, very high quality piece of work. So a superior fantasy com-rom, perhaps.
Yeah, well, actually, I mean, I recently, I don't know if you've seen the film Yesterday from 2019, this quote-unquote Beatles film where this guy wakes up in a world where nobody's heard of the Beatles and he's able to pass their songs off as his own. I did an audio review for my John Lennon podcast and absolutely trashed this film. What I said basically was that it was as if you'd taken the scripts of Notting Hill, Four Weddings and a Funeral, Love Actually, etc., put them in a blender and it had basically spat out this script and it was just all the cliches. So before I did that review, I was thinking, I did like a sort of perfunctory thing of on the internet, best 20 rom-coms. And the two that really leapt out was When Harry Met Sally, which I saw again a couple of years ago. I really like it. And this one. So I'm actually calling it a rom-com almost to say that this is how good a rom-com can be. So you can take the basic elements of a film with comedic lines that does have the ending that, the audience, say the mainstream audience, again, not to label, the cinema going audience probably want, for the two leads to get back together. I'm calling it that, like I say, to say that this is the pinnacle. This is what you can really do with it. I'm going to ask you in a sec about your history with this film, but I watched this again the other night with a commentary and I watched a couple of documentaries and it's one of those films that every time I watch a documentary, I was like, it just gets better and better. I absolutely love this film. I adore it. Can I ask you both, what's your history with this film? Like, how many times have you seen it? Does it get better every time you watch it? What's your overall, without going to specifics, what's your overall enjoyment of the film?
Okay, well, I didn't see it way back in the 1990s when it was created. I probably saw it first in the noughties and thought it was really good. I've seen it probably 3 or 4 times since, and I would say that each time I've seen it, it's got better. And the jokes, even though I know what's coming, I still find the jokes funny. And of course, preparing for this, I was thinking more deeply, you know, going to various articles on the internet about it, you know, the psychological aspects, the suggested metaphysical aspects, which I'm not quite so sure about. We'll come to that later. And so I've enjoyed it more on that level as well, thinking, oh yeah, there's actually more depth to this. Even though it's funny, there's still depth to it at the same time. So I would say that my appreciation of it has increased over time because it's that quality of production.
And Jennifer?
I don't remember the first time I saw it, but it was quite a while back. It may well have been in the 90s when I saw it the first time. But I happened to just watch it somewhat recently, like this summer. And that's when I woke up to all these other things about it, because I think the first time I watched it, I was definitely too young to be really thinking that deeply about all the things that the main character Phil is going through. But this summer, I was really surprised by and kind of opened my mind to so much more psychological depth of what was happening with him. And then, of course, just recently in preparation for this, of course, a couple times. So yeah, it's really an interesting and engaging. So that's a really nice balance to it, just being comedic. It's just got so much depth of interesting things happening with the main character, Phil. So, yeah.
I think it's a work of art. You know, one of the things that people say about a work of art is that as you come back to it time and time again, you find more in there. I think that's true of this, which testifies, I think, to its status.
I think it's also a wonderful thing with films and also with music, you know, with albums, for example. When you return back to them, it's fascinating to see how they've aged, you know, and the ones which have the real quality, they're never going to get old, really. I mean, I'm sure if we watch this film 25 years from now, there might be things in it that, you know, society has deemed are not acceptable anymore. I tend not to follow that myself. I tend to try and see the film, judge it by the standards of when it came out, you know. I mean, you could still discuss things in it that may have aged, but I think quality is quality, really. And
it reminds me of that silly business of expurgating Fawlty Towers by taking out certain, you know, racist elements. Some of that did happen, didn't it, recently? And I think whichever production company it was backtracked on that, but they had expurgated it to a certain extent. And I thought that was quite ridiculous because I think John Cleese himself was amazed that happened because it misunderstood the humor, because the humor was actually poking fun at the kind of racist attitudes of the people in the show. But there we are. Yeah, you've got to understand these things in their own terms, haven't you?
Yep. Okay, so I'll just go through the plot. I won't take very long with this. I mean, everyone, surely, if you're listening to us, you've probably seen the film. And so we know the basic story. So Phil Connors is a weatherman played by Bill Murray. We'll get to Bill Murray a bit later. And he goes with his producer, Rita, and his cameraman, Larry. And they go to a place called Punxsutawney, is in Pennsylvania, I think.
Yes.
And, yeah, it's February the 2nd. It's Groundhog Day. And the idea is that the groundhog, which is it some sort of large squirrel? Am I right? I'm just trying to think of
That's a line from the movie.
Looks like it.
It's not exactly like a squirrel, but it's a ground-dwelling creature.
Yeah, one of the rodent family, I think. Yes.
Yeah.
It's quite big, isn't it?
More like a mole.
Yeah, is it more like a mole? Oh, okay, yeah. Okay. Anyway, the idea is that if it emerges and sees its shadow due to the weather being clear, it will return back to its den, and winter will continue for 6 more weeks. If it doesn't see its shadow due to clouds, spring will arrive early. Is it just a superstition, or has the groundhog been found to be accurate? Any ideas?
I've got a story about that. I found out that the Washington Post did an analysis of weather data with respect to this question. And there's an article on their website called 30 Years of Groundhog Forecast Mapped. This is back in 2015. And the editor's note to the article says, our colleagues in the graphics department had a burning question. Can groundhogs really predict the weather? They ran the numbers on 250 cities over 30 years. Here's what they found. I won't tell you what they found. All I'll say is that when you look at the graphic that they've created, you can see it's pretty much 50-50, which is what you'd expect. But if you want to check out the details, yeah, there is that article. They did bother to do it, and good on them for doing it.
They must have had huge crowds since the film, I suppose. Is it still going on, presumably, if it's been going on for years?
It goes on all over the place, doesn't it, Jennifer? In the States and in Canada?
As far as the actual, like, a ceremony for the groundhog, you know, I don't know, to be honest. I would guess, perhaps. I mean, I would just hear about it, but I never really knew where it was being, you know, held or where it was being celebrated.
No, I'm just trying to think, particularly the year after this film. I'm wondering whether it looks like thousands of people went there for it. I don't know.
I see.
Yeah. So anyway, we're basically on day one, aren't we, really? And what we see about Phil, we'll, as I say, we'll definitely talk about the character a bit more later on, but he comes across as a kind of a city snob, I suppose. You know, he makes a few cracks about small town folk, and it's very cynical about the whole thing, going through the motions. The Rita character, Andy McDowell's character, is a lot more optimistic, just seems a lot more a calm person. Anyway, so as everyone will know, then Phil retreats back to his bed and breakfast room on his own, wakes up the next day, 6 o'clock, Sonny and Cher's "I Got You, Babe." First of all, he says he can hear the DJs doing their spiel. He's like, "Oh, nice going, boys. You're playing yesterday's tape." Pulls back the curtain, sees, and he's like, "What?" And we're sort of introduced to a couple of sort of recurring characters, if you call it. So there's an old homeless man that he walks past, doesn't give him any money. I think he even said, "Oh, I'll see you tomorrow" or something. And then we see the amazing character, Ned Ryerson, the insurance man. just brilliant. Yes. And I saw an interview with the actor, and he was saying when he went in for his audition, he said, "I just did it big. I went as far as you could possibly go with this character," and he added all loads of his own nuances, and they absolutely loved it. So
it was great.
Yeah. Stephen Tobolowsky.
Have you seen him in anything else? I'm trying to think. I'm sure he was in
I recognized his face, but I couldn't. Right.
Yeah, you feel like with that face, he would have played all comedy characters, but he was in Single White Female, I remember.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, playing a non-comedic character. So we kind of get the first, I think, 2 or 3 days, don't we? And then obviously, you know, it goes forward and it's been months and months and months. He goes to a psychiatrist. And this is a great line. The psychiatrist says, "I think we should meet again. How's tomorrow for you?" And going back to what we were saying about, is it a comedy? There's not loads of laugh out loud lines, but there's some witty stuff. And I think Bill Murray's delivery is just so brilliant that...
Yes, absolutely.
You know?
Yeah, that's one of the things I really enjoy about this film, is that there are gags. It's not like it's absolutely peppered with gags throughout, but there are. But they don't really come over that way, do they? Because they're so embedded in the structure of the film. They naturally flow out of what's going on. I think it's really cleverly done. I enjoy it very much.
Yeah. So rather than me waffling on, I'm going to sort of go through the stages and I'll get you both to comment. So basically through the film, there's sort of 4 or 5 transitions in terms of how Phil deals with this. So the first one is he's drinking in a bar with a couple of truckers, and he's saying, this is on about the third day or something. He says, "What would you do if, you know, the day was repeating?" And one of them says, "Well, you could do whatever you like." And so a light bulb goes off. So we get the sort of no consequences stage of it. So he's driving on the railroad tracks. He's eating that massive table of desserts.
Yeah. I loved it. Piece of cake into his mouth in one go. It just cracked me up.
That was lovely, wasn't it? When she was quoting Sir Walter Scott's poetry to him, he just completely ignores that and ridicules it, really.
Yeah, and he's drinking coffee directly from the pot as well. It's just like, he puts an angel cake in his mouth in one go and then slugs her some coffee. It must be quite empowering, just that. I'm going to ask you later what you think if you're in this situation, but that first moment when you realize you can do anything you want, of course, it opens up all kinds of moral and immoral possibilities.
So, can I just go back to this business about jokes or gags, as I called them, being embedded in the structure? That sounds you know, a bit highfalutin nonsense. No, I don't mean it that. I do actually mean that, because going back to the scene at the bowling alley where Phil says, you know, let me quote him here, "What would you do if you were stuck in one place and every day is exactly the same and nothing that you did matters?" And he's talking to these two guys, and one of them just thinks for about 2 seconds and then says, "Well, pretty much sums it up for me."
Yeah.
It's a great joke of, you know, of a line. Lovely. It really works terribly well. But at the same time, that's quite an important point that's coming out, isn't it? Quite a question that's being asked by the whole film. You know, what would you do if you're stuck in this situation? And reflecting on, you know, very often our lives are quite humdrum in some ways, aren't they? So reflecting on that, how do we regard our lives when we feel in a situation where we're stuck and nothing changes? So quite profound existential questions there, at the same time making a joke out of it. So it's not just a gag, it is embedded in the narrative and structure. So that's why I think it's so clever. Well, one of the many ways I think it's so clever.
Yeah, and actually one of the other things was, did you guys find out any stuff about the original script? Because it was a bit different, wasn't it? It wasn't really written to be even as comedic as it is, if it is a comedy.
One thing I thought that was fascinating was, originally, when he finally comes out of his endless loop of Groundhog Day, and it's now February 3rd, they were going to have it be that he would realize that now Rita was stuck in her loop, which I think would have really detracted. I think them keeping it more focused on just one person's situation like that, I think, was a better way to go. But that's kind of fascinating.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I mean, I read that as well. What popped in my mind was that if some sort of Hollywood executive who loves the sort of comedy formula might have thought of having a sequel with Rita.
Oh, right.
Oh, it's like, no, please. Thank God they didn't do that. The other idea that I was reading about was that they actually were going to start it. You know, there's a scene where you can see that Phil can basically predict everything that's happened, going to happen.
Right.
And so he steals the money, the bag of money, doesn't he? Because he says, here comes the car, here come the people, blah, blah, blah. They actually were going to start it on about that third day or something and let the audience work it out. And often, I mean, I have a criticism of Hollywood that they do sort of spoon feed it to the audience, but I think they did the right thing. What do you think?
Well, all I would say is very difficult to imagine how the film would have been otherwise. It's so perfect as it is that I think any other version probably would have been inferior. So that's all I can say. Therefore, I think they probably did do the right thing, even though it seems rather formulaic, you know, or you start before the time loop happens and then the time loop happens. And then at the end, of course, it's all resolved. Yeah, but sometimes these traditional formulas can work well. So I think they work really well within that arch structure, for sure.
Part of what I like about the beginning is, you know, there are some things in there that give a little bit of, as you said, Julian, the kind of the embedded sorts of structure that's sort of getting set up so that you can really appreciate some of the things that are going to happen. And one of the things he says is they're in the van and they're headed to Punxsutawney and kind of arguing about why he doesn't want to be there and that sort of thing. And he says, can you keep a secret, Larry? You know, I'm probably leaving the station someday. And they're like, well, what's the matter? What's wrong with all of this? And he says, you know, somebody's going to see me interviewing a groundhog and think I don't have a future.
Yeah.
So I love that little kind of subtle line right there. It's really subtle and just passes quickly. But once you see the story and you go back a few times, you're like, oh, that's really great setup there. Yeah,
that's the thing. I mean, I was going to say that as well. Yeah, there's so many subtleties that this really is conducive to watching it a few times. When I was young, in my 20s, I would just watch things obsessively. So I had a kind of Groundhog Day almost, but it's nice to have a distance. I probably hadn't seen it for, I'd say probably 20 years. I've probably seen clips because, you know, it's a sort of film where if you look at any sort of film countdown programs, it's bound to appear somewhere. But it's so interesting. So he goes to the no consequences stage and he lives out his Clint Eastwood fantasy.
Right.
He obviously manipulates a lady into a one night stand, and I like the Jeopardy scene as well. Do you remember when he's watching Jeopardy? And not only is he getting all the answers right, but he starts giving the question before the answers even appeared. And it's the way Bill
Murray
does
it. Consternation of his landlady.
The landlady character. Yeah, it's fantastic.
Yeah, she's really good.
Yeah, and then we get through. We go to then obviously. It gets the downside and the suicide aspect. And I mean, again, you know, for a mainstream comedy, just because this did fairly well financially, pretty dark stuff. I mean, he actually says to Rita, I've been stabbed, shot, poisoned, frozen, hung and electrocuted.
And burned.
And burned. And of course, he didn't mention the ones we see as well, that he jumps off a building. But, you know, that we're putting the toaster in the bath. I mean, that's pretty hardcore, you know?
It is.
Yeah.
Well, I read that they were influenced by Kind Hearts and Coronets, which was a black Ealing comedy. Well, I saw it donkeys years ago. I don't remember a great deal about it, but I know that Alec Guinness was playing several characters within that. And it's very dark. It's, you know, it's about murders and the like. But I mean, you think of Ealing comedies as being quite family viewing, but that one that one deals with much darker things. So I can see why, you know, there's a connection there with certainly that aspect of the film where he's committing suicide repeatedly. It's that sort of darkness. Yeah.
I read that the assassins of the Russian mystic Grigory Rasputin used each of those methods that he named.
See, there's so many depths. You see, you could read about this film and then get so much more out of it. But you described it actually earlier as perfect, Julian. I'm going to agree with you in the sense that it strikes a perfect balance.
Yeah.
In that, you know, it never gets depressing. It is, again, I don't want to go back to this, whether it's a comedy or not, but it's an enjoyable night out at the cinema, let's call it. But there's so much profundity and you've got so many things to think about. But at the same time, you know, I'm sure there's a lot of people who just saw this film as a fairly feel-good film, and it works on that level. So I think it's the balance that it strikes that's so perfect.
Yeah, yeah. And that balance seemed to have evolved, because it wasn't like it was a story that was written then made into a film, was it? It was originally a story by this guy called Danny Rubin, scriptwriter. So back in 1990, he had, I think he read a vampire novel or something and thought, oh, you know, what would you do, you know, if you were immortal? How would you change if you had eternal life on this planet, kind of thing? But then he tried to introduce that to various producers and didn't really get very much. Is it 50 producers? Sorry, directors. He sent it to, and it was Ramis who eventually took interest in it. But then there was a kind of dialogue between these two for quite a long time, and it went through many different rewrites and changes, and then even Bill Murray himself got in on the later stages of it too, didn't he? So it seems to have been very much not a sort of committee thing, but it seems to have evolved over time with different people having their hands on it. And I noticed also that there were quite some deep discussions about it too. So I think that Ramis himself, Harold Ramis, though he was brought up apparently Jewish, wasn't it? He became much more interested in Buddhism, I think, through his marriage or something. So anyway, so they talked Buddhism and reincarnation as they were poring over this this script. And then they talked Superman as well. And then Bill Murray threw his oar in, saying he wanted it to be apparently more philosophical. And Harold Ramis saying, oh, no, I think it's more of a comedy. And somehow out of this blender has come this great work.
Yeah.
And speaking of the different ways it could have gone, I mean, they could have gone into many more dark things about murder and things like that, which they never touched. And that, you know, having that ability to stay balanced in that allowed it to be this weird thing that's hard to categorize. Is this a comedy? Yeah. Is this a philosophical? Is this fantasy? What is this? Keeps it in that feel-good stage and that sort of thing.
It does. Yeah, because the suicide thing, well, that's sad. If you haven't seen it, you think, oh, no, it's got really dark things like that. Well, it's a dark subject, but it's not treated that way, is it? It's just so stupid. It's so daft, and it is not a big part of the film. But you just think, this is just a big joke, and of course it is. It's a kind of light black comedy in that sense, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. But you know that process you were talking about, Julian, of the script, it wasn't without its consequences. Because did you guys read this, that Bill Murray and Harold Ramis didn't actually speak for 20 years? Until 2014, apparently.
Basically, when Harold Ramis was pretty much sick and getting pretty close to dying, they speak again? Yeah, there was quite a lot of animosity and frustration, I think, that was happening. Mostly, I think, from Bill Murray. But what I understand is, you know, there was just sort of this brew of things going on for him because he was in the middle of at the end of his marriage, Bill Murray's marriage, was having a lot of stress, apparently, from that. And then apparently he was, you know, calling and trying to get messages to Harold Ramis constantly, and Harold sent over the screenwriter to kind of iron everything out. And apparently that was part of the sort of making a break for Bill. He's like, Harold's not going to talk to me. We've been friends forever, you know, that kind of thing. But anyway, so a lot of different things. And then some of the disagreements of Bill wanting to have more philosophical and deeper put on it, you know? And so there was a lot of tension on the set, a lot of difficulties. Apparently Harold would be trying to explain a scene to him and Bill would say, bad Phil or good Phil? Just kind of interrupt him.
Yeah,
and say,
I love it. I love it. Yeah.
Some of what I read was just essentially Bill really trying to separate himself in his career from Harold Ramis. And, you know, a couple articles that pointed to Bill seeming to really want to not have his entire career be sort of based on Harold Ramis's works. Yeah. You know, Caddyshack, Stripes, Ghostbusters.
Well, what you guys have touched on is a couple of really classic artistic dilemmas. First of all is art versus commerce. So, you know, in this case it was a director, but you can imagine a producer would also be saying, well, could we just put a couple more formula elements? You know, this works really well with audiences. So that's just a classic dilemma. And again, just to go back to what I said earlier, they found this balance and they got it right. And sometimes that doesn't happen, but I think it happened here. And
well, the studios wanted to have an explanation, apparently, of how the time loop happened. There were some ideas about, I don't know, some weird time invention by some scientist goes wrong or something like this. And, you know, Ramis didn't really want to do anything. I don't think, you know, the writer either, Rubin, wanted anything to do with it. At least this is a hazy memory now from reading notes. But I believe they scheduled to film an explanation for the time loop late in the schedule deliberately so that they would run out of time and not have to put that in. So, you know, there was the commercial pressure from the studios to say, oh, come on, make this the formula, you know, make it a Nutty Professor or something. It would have been terrible. It's much better just to leave it totally unexplained.
You know, if this was in the 50s, it would have been radiation that would have caused it. If you ever go back and watch 50s sci-fi, it's always radiation.
That's how
Godzilla
got so big,
it's
from radiation.
That's it, yeah. The other thing I was thinking as you were talking about Bill Murray and Harold Ramis, the other classic dilemma is the artist who gets stuck being a comedian and wants to branch out. You know, as you said, he wants to get away from Ramis in a way. And apparently this was a bit of a transition film because then, I mean, Lost in Translation was quite a bit later, but I don't know what he did in the interim, but I think, it would have been a general transition. Just to finish off with the plot, really, I mean, he goes through the suicidal stage, as we said. And then where do you go from that? Well, he's obviously pursuing Rita, and originally, you know, he's very much manufacturing it. You know, he learns all about her, and then you get the brilliant slap montage, which I thought was great. And then...
Real slaps,
yeah, that's it. And then we get kind of the final stage where he reinvents himself as a sort of Good Samaritan Superman figure almost, you know, helping the old man. Of course, one of the things that people have pointed out is that, of course, he couldn't stop the old man dying. He takes him for soup and he does what he can. And then I love he rescues the boy falling out the tree. And after probably the thousandth time of doing it, he says, "You never say thank you. See you tomorrow, maybe." So those are great lines. And just one more thing about the script. You were saying, Julian, it was kind of written by committee. I think Bill Murray did actually ad-lib as well. And one of the ad-libs, apparently, in this final stage where he's being a Good Samaritan, he hugs the insurance man. He gives him a big hug. Oh, and apparently he improvised. He said, "I don't know where you're going, but could you call in sick?"
Excellent. That's awesome.
Apparently that's the way he works. He's, you know, a bit improvisatory in the way he does things.
Yes.
Yeah, I think he did that in Tootsie as well, according to Dustin Hoffman. Yeah. So, effortless segue into Bill Murray. I'm going to throw to you guys. What do we think of Bill Murray in this film?
I think he was excellent. I think it was his part. I can't quite imagine any of the other contenders pulling it off quite as well. They wanted to give it to Tom Hanks, but Tom Hanks said, "You know, I'm so used to playing the nice guy, I don't think people would accept me as the miserable piece of work at the beginning of the film." I think that's right. I don't think that would have worked so well. Michael Keaton was also, you know, I just don't think he'd have brought off the comic aspect so well. Yeah. Chevy Chase, I think that, you know, the weightier part of it wouldn't have worked with Chevy Chase. So, yeah, I think this...
I think even John Travolta had been suggested, which I can't imagine.
So, good heavens. Wow. Yeah.
I can't imagine. I think the interesting thing for me about Bill Murray is in other films as well, it's really hard to tell looking through his character to who he is as a human being, how much he really is that kind of like egotistical, sort of mean, sort of nice guy, you know? And it seems like it fits well, like what his natural personality probably is.
Well, it's interesting because Tom Hanks said something like that. He said that... you know, Murray is, quote, such a miserable on and off screen, that he'll be okay for it.
Yeah.
He can pull off the comedy so well on top of that.
You know, it's the delivery. You know, he's obviously a seasoned comedian. You know, he went through one of the SNL generation of the 70s.
Yes, yes.
For sure. Yeah. So I think that's a pretty good sort of breeding ground. Yeah, it was interesting. When I was thinking about the recording today, I was thinking I was probably going to say, I don't know if this is what Bill Murray's actually like, you know. But then listening to Harold Ramis as well talking about it, they're kind of saying this is kind of what Bill Murray's like. He's light and dark. So as you've got good Phil and bad Phil, you've kind of got good Bill and bad Bill at the same time, you know.
You know, there's always that slight little edge. And I couldn't tell. I kept thinking about it and thinking, is that little edge coming off because he's so ticked, you know, of all the things that are going on set, you know, and his marriage falling apart and all these kinds of things, you know, is all of that creeping into his acting or is that just him?
I feel like sometimes, it might even happen without you realizing it, you know. You channel your own life and any troubles you're going through probably just comes out, you know, in the moment. Yeah. I was trying to rack my brains of what other actors could have done this. And obviously, you know, there's loads of good actors that could have done it, you know, made a decent job of it. But if it was Tom Hanks, I feel like I don't know if you've seen Castaway, but I mean, the script wasn't great. It's a good film, yeah. It just seemed to be a bit like they could have got someone else. I'm not the biggest Tom Hanks fan, so I'm probably a bit biased. I think he's a very talented actor, but I was really trying to rack my brains and think who else could have done this, and I just can't think of anyone better.
Mm. It's difficult when you're reading commentaries on things to know quite what happened when, but, you know, Danny Rubin apparently told The Wrap that he didn't write it. This is the quote. "I didn't write it to be a broadly nasty person. If anything, I just wrote him to be a normal, average person just stuck in a circumstance." But then Harold Ramis said, "Oh, don't worry. This is what Bill Murray can do. He can be that nasty and still make you like him." Yeah. And Danny Rubin said, you know, he reassured me about that. And he was correct. So, you know, I get the impression that Harold Ramis had Bill Murray in mind, and it was what he could do that changed the nature of the script. I don't know that, but reading between the lines, I wonder if that's the case.
Yeah. Mm. What about Andie MacDowell? What do we think of Andie MacDowell in this film?
I think she does well. I don't think her character just has a ton to do, because it's kind of a static character in the sense that she's just who she is, and she stays the same throughout. She's sort of like a North Star, actually, to Phil, you know, and kind of like the whole personality of Phil sort of revolves around her in a sense. But her sweetness, her personality, apparently she naturally has a very thick North Carolina accent, and asked Harold if she could just use that, which she did. But anyway, she was homey, sweet, you know, all of those things, and stayed that throughout. But I think she acted it well, and she was very, you know, sweet character and did it really well. So,
I mean, this is so much revolves around Phil Connors, Bill Murray. I think you could say the same about the Larry character. I'm blanking on the guy's name.
Chris Elliott,
yeah. I mean, I didn't know much about him. Apparently, he was on the Letterman show, is that right? But I've seen him in a couple of other films, and he can do a lot more. And I think they just kind of had to accept that really the comedy had to come from the Phil character, I suppose.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. And that's why one of the main reasons why I admire Andie MacDowell in this, because she just accepted that she was a foil for him, and she just did it really well. And this is a quote from the producer, Trevor Albert: "With grace and confidence and intelligence, and that was what was required. It did not require somebody to be as comedic as Bill Murray, and that would have been wrong, although they apparently did audition female comedians initially. But that would have been wrong, because the balance would have been just completely destroyed by that. She was restrained in what she did, and I admire her for that. She did it really well, and she didn't try to steal the limelight. Perfect companion for him in the film.
Right.
Yeah, absolutely. And with Phil and Rita, that whole them as a couple or a potential couple, people have said, you know, light and dark, Beauty and the Beast. He's obviously very angsty. She seems to have peace of mind. You know, she says, "Oh, I go with the flow." So I don't know. I just can't think of any way they could have done this better, honestly.
There had to be a great contrast between them, didn't there, for the comedy to have come out, where he tries to accommodate himself to her character. I'm not quoting exact lines here, but where she says things like, "You know, I go with the flow," he would learn to say, "Oh, yeah, she goes with the flow, does she?" And so the next day he'll say, "I go with the flow." Well, that's not a line, but it's that sort of thing.
Yeah, the line where she says, "I always toast to world peace," and he's like, "Oh," rolls his eyes because he totally missed it.
That's what I mean. There's all these little nuances, and I mean, it's so kind of on the nose, you know, sweet vermouth with a twist, and, you know, as if she's thinking that she wouldn't like. I mean, okay, she's not going to really cotton on, because we get the impression that they don't really perhaps know each other very well. I don't know.
She was the new producer. She was the new producer, and the very beginning of the movie, he sees her. And that's the first time for him to see her. And then his helper, Kenny, is saying something about, "Yeah, that's Rita. She's the new producer. You're going to really like her. And she's a lot of fun. You know, you should stay there. I'll take the 5 o'clock for you." And he's like, "Yeah, she's a lot of fun, but not my kind of fun." And so he slips back into his jaded worldview sort of thing. Because it was obvious that that moment he looks at her, he sees something beautiful and sweet and totally unlike himself.
Yeah. But it's just too much for him at the beginning, I think. Any kind of optimism or, you know, lightness, he just rejects it, you know.
Yeah. Yeah.
He's fed up too, isn't he? He wants to move on to better things.
Yeah, he's waiting to get snapped up.
Yeah.
One thing I thought, again, this is so brilliant from, well, Bill Murray and the script and the direction. Do you remember when he proves to her that it's happening, you know, because he tells them all about everyone in the cafe, and then he knows when the tray is going to be dropped. And she stays with him till about 3 a.m., I think. And, and while she's asleep, he's talking to her and saying, you know, you're so sweet, and with the music and everything. And it could have been really soppy, but it just isn't. It's something in his delivery. I mean, it just works. I don't know. What do you think?
Yeah, I think George Fenton music, it works really well. It's not all by him, but he's a seasoned film composer, done an awful lot of TV work, a lot of film scores. And it's one of those scores where it's not like there's a big theme, is there, and you think, oh, this is getting developed throughout the film. There are lots of different styles of music and songs and things that are chosen for particular parts of the film that just suit what's going on, you know. And as far as the incidental music is concerned, I can't even think of it, you know. It was just what suited at the time, so I thought that was suitable. Yeah,
well, there was one that was sort of almost a bit reggae, the quite joyous one. I think it plays at the end, from memory. And then you've got there was a quite of an ominous one that was for the suicides or certain times. Yeah. Before we get on to the bit I'm really looking forward to, the sort of existential side of this, is there anything else that either of you want to say about the plot or the characters?
One thing that I think is totally forgivable, but when I reflect upon it, I think, didn't quite make sense. But then it's about it, because lots of it doesn't make sense, is that earlier on in the film, it was clear that he only ever had one day in order to woo Rita. Okay, and he fails over and over and over again. But, you know, he gets better at it. He learns. But he's always got this time constraint. He only ever has one day. And as a consequence, he's under pressure to, you know, to impress her. But later in the film, he does woo her within one day. He learns to push aside his darker side more, and he goes more to his lighter side and allows himself just to be himself, or his lighter self, his better self. And when he does that and stops trying so hard, okay, she falls in love with him, but still within one day. So I still find that constraint was there, and it's therefore implausible. But I think by the time you've got to that point in the film, your experience transcends that day, and you remember, oh yes, they've been through all this together. Of course she'd love him by now.
It's a strange
trick,
isn't it?
We're kidded into that. Yeah, it is a strange trick, but it works. When you think about it, it doesn't make sense, but that's fine.
I mean, I kind of put that down to the magic of film, in that, if I can just bring up for a second Jaws, which is a film that's just from childhood, it's just sort of seeped into my consciousness. I can see the flaws in it, but, you know, obviously most people all know, you know, the way that Brody kills the shark is he puts a compressed air tank in the shark's mouth and then shoots it, and the shark explodes. And when they decided to do that, I think it was one of the writers said to Steven Spielberg, that would never happen. Or one of the technical people said, that would never. Steven Spielberg said, if I've got them for 1 hour and 59 minutes, you know, the 2 hour film, they'll let me get away with it, believe me. So I think that's what it is, you know. When you feel like you're in safe hands, they can get away with a few sort of tropes. Yes. And
yeah.
Yeah. A slight unbelievability about what really can actually happen with the human heart in just 12 hours.
Yes, it's a funny trick they play with you. One thing I absolutely love, the party at the end, he's obviously playing the blues piano. And I love the fact that his piano teacher said, oh, he's my student.
Yes.
That, even though to her, she only met him that morning.
That's right. That's right.
So he obviously, but then we know that, in fact, she does take the credit, because she, you know, she has been teaching him for, you know, 10 years, you know.
You know, I love she makes this comment one time where she says, are you sure this is your first piano lesson? He says, well, my father was a piano mover, so that helped.
Yeah, I love it. Another great line.
Quick question, and just how long was it? I've heard of, there's some sort of website called Wolf Gnards. Nards says 8 years, 8 months, and 16 days. The website Movie Truth says 12 years, 6 months, and 11 days. And then another site says just under 34 years to account for his mastering piano, ice sculpture mastery, things like that. Yes. But apparently only 38 days depicted in full or partially are actually in the film.
Oh, interesting. Well, yeah, I mean, the original script idea was 10,000 years.
Oh, wow.
Is it? Poor Howard Ramis got involved. And I love the idea of that, because it just takes a film to a whole new level. Suddenly you're talking about, like, an amazing fantasy, someone traveling through millennia. But I would say, as a musician, starting from scratch, if you were a diligent piano student, maybe 5 years just for the piano, don't know.
There's the 10,000 hour concept where you can master in 10,000 hours. So I don't know what that translates to. Like, that's roughly kind of a 10-year thing if you're doing it at a reasonable pace. It's, you know, not like 8 hours a day or something. But do you remember that he made that comment when they're throwing the cards in the hat? He and Rita are sitting on the bed and they're throwing the cards in the hat. She said, this would take somebody years to master. He said, no, only 6 months, 4 or 5 hours a day.
That's it. Yeah, there you go.
Yeah.
I feel
like
the ice sculpting would be a long time as well. I've never tried that, so I don't know.
Sure it would. I think I read somewhere 70 to 80 years. I'd go for that. Well, that makes sense to me.
Isn't that amazing? Because what would you do? Would you... In fact, let's find a nice segue. I'm going to ask both of you. I'll give you my 2 cents afterwards. But what stages do you think you would go through? Or how would you feel about this? Would there be any part of you that wouldn't want it to end? Or would you be always hoping it would end? Jennifer, go on. You first.
Yeah, I don't know. I think about this amount of time, and we're talking like 10,000 years, or we're talking 8 years, we're talking 12 years. I think that would really drive me insane, really insane. Yeah. I don't know if I could ever come out of that healthy by the end of it. But I think there would be a sense in which I would long to come out of it. But then I would almost wonder if psychologically I'd almost like forget like how life could be any other way than the same day every day.
Yes, I think in reality you would.
Yeah, I mean, there's so many comparisons you could draw. I mean, to me, I feel like it's almost a bit like winning the lottery, in that suddenly you've got no pressure of, you know, because obviously he's got one day, he's already got a job, so he's got no pressure of earning money, let's say, or, you know, he's got no economic pressure. Actually, they did a survey, here's a little bit of trivia, a few years ago of national lottery winners. So we have a thing called the National Lottery in England. They actually did a survey and they asked them at the end if you could push a button and not having won the lottery. And apparently, and I don't always trust stats, just over 50% said they wish they hadn't won.
Yeah.
Which just blows your mind, doesn't it? You think, how can that be?
Yes. You were going to ask, what would you do if you were in a similar situation in the time loop? And I actually thought of winning the lottery because, you know, he does the game show, doesn't he, where he knows all the answers and the next day he can answer them all. And I thought, well, you know, wouldn't I check out the winning numbers in Euro Millions?
Absolutely.
Because then the next day I could go back and fill in that number and I would be the person to win 70 million, you know, on that day. But then I thought, yeah, but you wouldn't be able to spend that money anyway, so it would be pretty pointless. So.
Exactly. And the buzz would wear off. That's why it is it's like winning the lottery, isn't it? Because, you know, I've never won the lottery or been particularly rich, I can tell you that. But I'm sure the buzz would wear off, you know. And the other comparison I was making would be like if you were stuck on a desert island. I'm a big fan of Desert Island Discs, which I'm sure Julian's heard of. It's a BBC radio staple that's been going for probably about 10,000 years itself.
Feels like it.
But no, they get celebrities fictitiously stranded on an island. They have to name the 8 records they take with them and one luxury and one book. And I was thinking, I've got to be honest, I would love to be stuck on a desert island for about 3 months. Anyway, sorry, I did ask you a question. What would you do or what would you think? Sorry, I'm jumping around all over the place. Jennifer, what about you?
I just keep thinking that it would just come to a point where I became almost comatose with depression.
Yeah.
Well, I noticed that actually he's very relieved when it all finishes. Well, obviously, he's gained the love of Rita. But, you know, I think he looks out the window, doesn't he? And actually, there are not the cars going down the same road today. And he's delighted by that. Oh, wow, it's over. So even though he'd had these sort of godlike powers, not the god, but a god, not exactly omniscience, but a sort of mini omniscience, but which he likes, he clearly enjoys doing that. But not so much that he's quite happy to return to his normal creatureliness, you know, his proper status as a created being. He just looks out the window, what a relief. So actually, I think even though obviously being in a situation like that would confer many, many benefits, it would also take away from, you know, what you're supposed to be, a human being living with other human beings, with all the relationships that we have. That would all be broken, would all be distorted. So however good it would be, you'd be relieved to get out of it, I reckon.
Well, I think the idea of being able to do anything, that's been, I think, explored a lot in literature and film, probably over thousands of years. And And in the end, the buzzer would just wear off, you know, whatever it is.
It would.
You know, if you discovered you could fly, you know, I'm sure it'd be great. But, you know, after a while, it'd become, oh, I can fly, you know.
It's like a 16-year-old who finally gets to drive. And by the time they're 30, they're like so sick of driving.
Yeah, well, that buzz lasted quite a long time for me because I failed my test a couple of times. So I never thought I'd ever drive. So, but I know what you mean. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Perhaps we need, you know, the messiness of life, perhaps.
I think we do. And I think what this does actually is to show that the only thing you can really change is yourself. That's a very key thing about the film, isn't it? It doesn't matter what else you do, win the lottery, impress somebody, whatever. It's gone the next day. But, you know, paradoxically, the way in which he changes internally is carried from one day to the next. So when he learns how to play the piano, that carries on. So when he comes out at the end, it's just the way that he has changed that transcends the loop, which is interesting. Says, you know, that's what really matters. How we ourselves change is what matters.
Mm. Is that not really the lesson we all have in this life, is whatever's going on around you, how are you going to respond to it? And how are you going to see yourself in that? And what are you going to do with the time you have for yourself and for your betterment so that you can be a better human being? So I think.
Yes, indeed.
It's really true.
Am I allowed a moment of theology here?
Of course you can.
You invite me on, you're going to get a bit of theology. We'll come on to this in a minute, won't we, about theology, philosophy, etc. I think some of the suggestions as to how it connects to that is very spurious, tenuous, doesn't convince me. But one thing I do think, having talked about what we just have about sort of becoming more authentically human, you know, what you're supposed to be as a human being, I see, okay, he goes through the film improving, and that's great. But then what about from a theological point of view, God? All right, he finds out he's not a god. He's a little god, not really a god at all. But I see the relationship between him and Rita as being the development of this relationship, perhaps, you know, with the divine, with God. And so he improves as a person and finds his sort of enlightenment or his redemption by being in true relationship to her. And so, you know, I'm just trying to reflect upon it Christianly, as my website goes. You know, I see that as a sort of coming to a relationship with the creator. I'm not saying the film's saying that. That's just trying to make sense of it in my own mind. What do I get out of it? You know, finding that ultimate relationship. And that transcends the loop, you know?
Yeah, I get what you're saying. And I think I would add, or for my own twist on this, and this is what I'm going to talk about with the psychological side of things. You know, I see him as being very narcissistic. And within that, you know, category, the problem with narcissism, and I'm not saying he is a narcissist, but just those narcissistic tendencies, is really a true break in relationship. And even theologically, I see attachment theory, things like that, very much from a theological standpoint, where we're created to be in relationship with God. We're created to be in relationship with each other. And on every level, with people, with God, we struggle with that. We have problems with that. We have ways that we don't do that well. But for exactly what you're saying, the real finality, kind of the pinnacle of all of this for him, is to finally actually have a real relationship, and it to be really about the mutuality, the connection, the attachment that is really necessary to have a true relationship like we would need to have with God, like we need to have with other human beings.
Yeah. If I put another spin, because I mean, this is one thing that struck me, as you know, I've been doing a podcast about John Lennon for a couple of years. I've got a huge interest in psychology. And one of the things that I've read a lot about is fame. Yes. And we were talking about, you know, his situation's a bit like winning the lottery. And I think it's also a bit like being famous. And I've never been famous. So I have a tiny bit of fame in podcast land, but that's about it.
You've been on TMR many times. You're very famous.
Yeah. And I do get messages from all around the world as well. So, slightly famous. But no, the point I was going to make is that when you become famous, from everything I read, again, all your dreams come true, in that everybody wants to hear what you have to say. Everybody's constantly telling you you're wonderful. But in the end, you need something real, because the downside of fame is that the people that will then approach you are approaching you as a god, you know, as a rock god, for example, if you're a musician or a film god. And I'm sure, obviously, Bill Murray's had a bit of that because he was a pretty huge star already then. Yeah. So it's the same thing, you know. It's just my thing is about how all the buzz of everything kind of rubs off, and maybe only like your real relationships with the creator, if you believe in it, or with other people. That's what matters, you know. And so I do agree with you. You know, I think we're pretty much all on the same page, actually.
I think we are, and I think we may need to make it clear for listeners that we're not saying these are the kinds of things that definitely the film is saying. It's saying something similar to that, but it's not like this is a metaphysical film. It's not. I mean, that it seems clear to me that this loop idea is a device, you know, for all the things the film is trying to do. It's not. It doesn't even try to explain what this loop is, and the idea of then reading off a metaphysics. You know, metaphysics about this and saying, oh, it's a, you know, it's kind of eternal return, an endless cycle. You know, that doesn't work because the things do change. You know, each day he changes things in his relation to other people and things. So it's not a kind of eternal return sort of thing, although there's an element of that. It's not reincarnation. You know, I know that Ramis himself is, you know, influenced by Buddhism, and that's kind of in the background there, but it isn't reincarnation, is it? Because he comes back as himself every time. He's not got a different body. He's not. On, you know, some sort of a different stage of creaturely being or anything like that. He's always himself.
Right. Yeah.
He's not a
always himself.
He's not like a Buddha figure.
I was saying always himself, yet with the changes that have come from the previous experiences. Yeah.
I think actually what comes closest to this is to abandon any metaphysical consideration for it at all and just look at it as an existential thing, where he is just he has this crisis of being. And his indulgences no longer satisfy him. He gets into depression and he escapes from that through self-improvement and relationship with others. I don't think there's any metaphysics to this. That's all the device, you know, or the suggestion of that is just the device that makes all the rest of it, the psychological aspect, which, you know, which I think is the core of it and makes all that work.
You know, as we talked about at the beginning, there's so many things that they could have explained or could have tried to do with it that they didn't do. And that left it really open, I think. And that gives us a lot of leeway for just kind of like, okay, well, this is an interest. I think to me, it's just like interesting reflections that maybe highlight something in my own understanding of life that I'm able to like look at this and say, oh, wow, that's really fascinating how that can reflect that for me.
Yeah.
Well, again, I talked about balance earlier. I mean, really, what if you just think of the plot on its face, so to speak, they just give you the ending that, in one sense, they give you the ending that, let's say, a mainstream audience would like. It's very simple. He improves. But then, like you say, it's something about the way they make it. And I've never made a film, so I can't tell you exactly how they do it. But, you know, it's a work of art, as you said earlier, Julian. I really think it is. Here's a question for you. Is there any significance to the fact that the groundhog and Phil Connors are both called Phil? What can we read into that? Let's really go wild.
Yeah. I love that. I thought about that a number of times, but I don't know that I came up with anything amazing about that, but I just love that the association with him, the day, you know, initially the hatred he has for the day, all of those kinds of things. It's so almost like it's a foreshadowing of just his inexorable intertwining with his fate, you know?
Yes, I think that's right.
I suppose the clearest parallel is of Phil is, sorry, the groundhog Phil. You know, he's kept in this, what do you call it, hutch? What do you call the thing he's in?
Burrow? In the tree stump. It was a tree stump.
Oh, right, yeah. Well, he's in his, almost like he's in his cage almost. You know, they,
yeah, they the cage.
Bring him out.
The truck, yeah, yeah, okay.
That's right, yeah. So maybe it's a bit on the nose parallel, but, you know, he's obviously stuck in a prison of this time loop. I always thought Phil and Bill as well, Phil Connors, Bill Murray. It was almost like saying that Bill Murray was almost a bit like this, you know, as we said, we found out that Bill Murray is a bit like that. But the names thing is interesting because have you ever seen the Alfred Hitchcock film Shadow of a Doubt? Or have you ever heard of that?
No.
It's not one of his most famous. They do a really clever thing. I mean, it wasn't Hitchcock, it was a scriptwriter, but it's Joseph Cotten as Uncle Charlie. And he comes from a small town, but he's become a sort of city high flyer. He comes back to visit his family and he has a niece who's also called Charlie. So obviously Charlie works as a man's or woman's name. And this niece really adores him. And he turns out to be a killer, in fact. It's a really good lesser-known Hitchcock film. I don't know if they had that in mind. But,
who knows?
Well, yeah. So many layers. What else can we talk about? I've exhausted my notes, but is there anything else?
Oh, really? Well, I did want to get to his kind of running through like how I saw the narcissistic transition from where he started in the movie to where he ended. So I really saw some strong sensibility of narcissism within the character of Phil, obviously. And I think it's interesting, you know, this was in the early 90s and people weren't really talking about narcissism like we do today. You know, we in America, we've just recently ousted a narcissistic president. So everybody knows about narcissism. But in the early 90s, I love that, you know, they're in the van at the beginning of the movie and they're headed to Punxsutawney. And oh, no, I'm sorry. I think that was maybe later in the cafe. And Phil says something to Rita about thinking that he's egotistical. And she says, yes, that's like the defining characteristic of your personality. Is so, you know, that's kind of the word of the day at that point in time. But having done a little bit of informal, just as a normal person, informal study of narcissism, you know, the core of narcissism is shame. And so with a oblivious narcissist, which I love that term, that's the narcissist that people typically think of. They're, you know, really, you know, throwing out this projected image of themselves being grandiose and amazing and all this sort of thing. The term for that is oblivious narcissism. I love that. But so what I saw with him is, you know, at the very beginning, he has this outward shell that he's projecting, you know, and constantly talking about himself and how excellent he is. And every single interaction with everybody is to belittle them. And even when he sees Rita at that very moment at the beginning, he looks at her, sees her, he's obviously affected by her. And then he says, you know, she's not my kind of fun. You know, next thing he says is people are morons. And he's talking about blood sausage and things like this, you know. You know, that all establishes him as just, you know, entirely about himself. Everybody else and everything else is just moronic and stupid and lower than himself, you know. And then he goes through this stage of, you know, I can get away with anything, right? And that's when he starts to get anything he wants. And I see in narcissists that they're really out to get whatever they want and whatever means it takes for them. And then the next stage is I can get anything I want. So now he has the ultimate opportunities for manipulation. He realizes, oh, you know, all those manipulation skills I have, this is like winning the lottery on the capacity to manipulate, you know, and that's when he goes through all these things about learning things about other people that he can use to get what he wants.
That's where he slightly touches on the psychopath there, doesn't he? Just slightly.
Yeah.
I mean, he never quite reaches the level of somebody who has that kind of charm and influence. But yeah, he's kind of a wannabe psychopath at a certain moment in the film, I think.
Yeah. Yeah. Then he has this realization that the payoff is empty. Even though he's getting kind of everything he wants, he's finally realizing this is just not really getting me what I want ultimately. And he doesn't even know, I don't think he has purpose yet or an understanding of even what he wants. Because that's the other characteristic of a narcissist is they're just so hollow in terms of even knowing themselves, really. And so Rita, you know, I love this because the first time he starts to get to know Rita, she's starting to go through her list of guy attributes that she likes. And she says all of them.
Me,
humble. Yeah. And he wouldn't say that he's humble. That's definitely me, he says. But the funny thing is, you know, he's like, me, that's me. Oh, I'm this and I'm that. And then as soon as she says, not afraid to cry in front of me, which also spoke to the whole issue of the shame thing, right? Because a narcissist is not going to show their vulnerability. He stops and says, is this a man we're talking about?
Yeah. He's not afraid to change poopy diapers. Right. Do we have to use the word poopy?
Exactly. So it's funny, but it also, from my little narcissistic framework that I started nerding out on, it's also like, okay, what is a narcissistic man taught? They're not allowed to be vulnerable. They're not allowed to cry. They're not allowed to be gentle. They're not allowed to love babies. They're going to be a man, right? And then this is when he finally decides, okay, now I can't kill myself. So what am I? Now he's really questioning, who am I? What am I? And this is where he comes to this, okay, so in a narcissistic way, instead of thinking, I don't know what he could think, some sort of humble creature of some kind, he decides he's a god. Which I love that.
Yeah.
And he tries to convince Rita that he's a god, right? And then that's the first time she actually stays through the night to try to, you know, witness this changing of the time and everything else. And that's when they had that really tender moment. And this is, you know, this is pretty far in. This is like a little more than two thirds away through the film. And he has that tender moment where it seems like to me, this is finally, he has to go all the way through, in some sense, if I look at it sort of from a Christian perspective, dying to himself. through all of the suicides. I mean, dying to himself before he finally truly sees her and begins to see the lack and the void within himself. So he finally sees her. He's in the bed with her as she's falling asleep, like 3 a.m, that sort of thing. And that's when he goes through this litany of all these things that he finally really sees true about her, like the beauty in her, the goodness in her. And then just the realization that those are all these things that he's never, ever possessed. And at that point, he then begins to go on his quest toward this, we've called it self-improvement, but like quality characteristics of his own being, you know? And the very first thing after that is he sees the homeless man and he pulls out his money, he's starting to count the money, and then he just gives them the whole wad. And then he brings the coffee to them and starts actually getting to know them, to know Larry and Rita and those sorts of things. That's the beginning of all the unselfishness. And then it becomes, you know, just over and over and all these different things. The other thing I thought was beautiful about it was, it's not just that he's going and helping people. Then he goes, the other thing I was going to say about that was really great is as he begins to do these things like reading literature, reading poetry, learning to make music and play music and all these things, I find that we're not just seeing him becoming like a more eligible bachelor for Rita or something like that. We're seeing him see the world differently, see people differently with a depth that he never had before, where he's not only engaging with people because he knows them as he's been getting to know them through all these different activities he's doing with them and that sort of thing, but he's engaging with people through the mindset of someone who can see the world more broadly and deeply through art and through these deeper ideas and philosophies and things like that. And so by the end, you know, the irony, of course, by the end is that he's not only, in some sense, he was trying to figure out how he could be worth Rita ever caring for him or loving him. And by the end, she's seeing his value and literally buying him, betting on him, right, at the end. And I find all of that really fascinating. But to me, I kind of look at this as a summary of like, what does it take? It would take, I don't know, 10,000 years of a repeated day for a narcissist to finally become a man who can truly love and see other people and connect and have attachments in a healthy and beautiful way.
Fascinating. Fascinating. Wow, and amazing. That turning point that you mentioned about when they're there in the 3 o'clock in the morning on that bed, and he is saying to her how much he appreciates her in many ways. And I think it's wonderful that moment because she can't hear what he says. She's asleep, but he goes on speaking to her. And so it's not about, you're clear at that moment, it's not about him trying to manipulate her at that point. This is what he really thinks. And it's a lovely moment.
Do you want some amazing bit of trivia about that, actually? Bill Murray, when he got married, him and his wife on their honeymoon, apparently they got quite blotto, got quite drunk, and she fell asleep. And he did that with his wife.
Right.
So I wonder if that was his script idea. Yeah, he told her all the things that he wouldn't tell her when she was awake.
Oh, that's interesting. Oh,
it's brilliant, isn't it? One thing, perhaps, Julian, we could talk about Elizabeth Kubler-Ross's 5 stages of death and dying. The acronym is DABDA, denial, anger, bargaining, depression, and acceptance. So does the film follow that slavishly or in a more sort of roundabout way? What do you think?
Well, I tried to see it in the film because it was suggested in the notes that I came across that they were influenced by this. And I think it pretty much conforms to it, but not perfectly. But I think there's a question connected with that. Mm. So we have that, you know, Phil is confused about what's going on. Initially, he does go into denial because he visits a doctor and a psychiatrist. You know, he doesn't accept, oh, this is a real time loop that's happening here. There must be something wrong with my head. So there's a kind of denial there, I think. Then he goes to panic. That conforms with anger. And I think he expresses that anger through this nihilism. You know, he's angry at life. Mm-hmm. He drives the car or the railway track, you know, towards the train. And apparently connected with this is blaming other individuals. And we get to the bargaining. Now, this is I don't see the bargaining. I'll come back to that in a second. We get to depression. Well, that's very clear. He becomes ridiculously depressed. You know, he enjoys taking his own life many, many times. Mm-hmm. And then we get acceptance at the end. Clearly, he accepts the situation, concentrates on enjoying it and trying to make the best of it and the best of himself, etc. It's the bargaining thing. But I noticed that there was a scene that was not in the film that was planned to be in the film where he goes to pray in a church at a certain point.
Interesting.
And so I wondered if they thought that he would sort of pray to God, say, look, well, if I perhaps if I'm a better person, God, you'll release me from this situation. Could have been, but they obviously decided not to include that. So I just wonder whether it does conform, but not perfectly now because of a change, probably a good change that they, you know, that they made. Yeah.
Yeah. Wouldn't the tendency be, again, for the sort of commercial-minded Hollywood to have him sort of praying in a church and then for his prayer to be instantly answered, as if someone who's never been in a church can go in a church, pray to God, and then instantly it happens? Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, perhaps there were so many difficult questions connected with that, it was not worth messing about with.
But you're not saying they would have put that right at the end, so the prayer was instantly answered, would you? Or...
Well, I was wondering whether they were going to put it in the middle, because it comes in the middle, doesn't it? You know, of her five stages. I think that it would have been a mistake, because it would have introduced a metaphysics into the film, that there is the created order and there is the God to whom you can pray and who can change things. None of that is present in the film. It's just this mysterious loop that takes place that he interacts with, and then he's freed mysteriously from the loop. It sidesteps any metaphysic at all. So I think that would have been quite a deep problem to have introduced into the film.
That's what I think as well. Yeah, they just left it. Trust the intelligence of the audience or the curiosity of the audience to fill in a potential gap for themselves.
You know, there's another stage that this lady, Elizabeth, what is her name again, Elizabeth?
Kubler-Ross.
Yeah. Yes, Kubler-Ross says that she would like to see kind of added to this, and that's the stage of meaning, like a sixth stage of meaning. And I'm kind of curious if you think, Julian, that meaning possibly develops in his experience towards the end.
Well, we're left with the question, what is the meaning, aren't we? So perhaps we could add that ourselves, saying, I'd like to add that as the sixth element to this, which we do. Inevitably, we bring our own worldview to it and search for a meaning through the lens of that.
Yeah, great stuff. I'm sure we could keep going, but I think we've done a fairly, fairly thorough job. Hardly needs me to say, really, that we're all recommending this film, right? Or has anyone suddenly decided they hate it after this conversation? No.
You know, I think it's a sign of a good film if we can watch it this many times, go through and discuss it this many times, and still say, you know what, I'd like to see that again sometime.
Yeah, definitely. Very true. It's got that lasting quality, Definitely.
Thanks very much, Anthony, for inviting us on. I've enjoyed it very much.
You're welcome. It's been great. So just before you go, Jennifer and then Julian, could you just tell us where we can find you online and all that traditional podcast stuff?
Okay. Go on, Jennifer.
Okay, thank you. Yes, you can find my music website online at Jennifer with one N, J-E-N-I-F-E-R, Tyson, T-H-Y-S-S-E-N. And it's just one word, Jennifer Tyson. It's jennifertyson.com.
Excellent. Sorry. There you go. All right, Julian.
Yeah, and you can find The Mind Renewed at themindrenewed.com.
Fantastic.
And in fact, if you go there to the links tab, you will find Jennifer Tyson's website mentioned, so you can go through from there if you like.
Fantastic. And for Julian's audience, I've got three podcasts: Glass Onion on John Lennon, obviously about John Lennon / Beatles, Film Gold, which is the one that we're on now, and then Life and Life Only, which is a bit more general, psychology, alternative media. Crossing over almost a bit of TMR territory. I feel like I might have some of the same guests. I've already had James Corbett, so it's definitely a bit of crossover.
Good discussion. Really enjoyed that discussion with James
Corbett. Yeah, it was great. I mean, he's an alt media legend, isn't he, really?
Yes,
Pretty much 15 years, or I think he's done about 10 years full-time. Tackling the truth about the world, which is not an easy thing to do. And I've got some music actually as well. Anthony Rotuno, Anthony without an H, at bandcamp.com.
Awesome.
So thank you very much. It's been amazing. And sure, we'll speak again in the future.
Yeah, thank you so much, Anthony. And also, Julian, thank you so much.
And everybody, please watch Groundhog Day.
Absolutely. Again.